Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for waiting. Welcome to the Lowy Institute today. We are honoured to have in our audience today our board member, Stephen Lowy, as well as members of the Lowy family and the extended Lowy Institute governance and supporters community. We're particularly grateful to have here today members of our very generous supporters circle and our corporate members whose support is really crucial to our work, so thank you. My name is Alex Oliver and I'm the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute. Before taking on this role, I led the Institute's Public Opinion and Diplomacy Program for several years. And Dr. Michael Fullilove, who is addressing us today, is the Executive Director of the Institute, my colleague for more than a decade, and of course my boss. For those of you who are not as familiar with Michael's background as I am, Michael has been at the Lowy Institute since its creation in 2003 and played a central role in establishing and developing the Lowy Institute. He wrote the feasibility study for the Institute in 2002, and that was instrumental in the decision by the Lowy family to create the Institute. Michael was director of the Institute's Global Issues Program from 2003 until his appointment as executive director in 2012. He has also worked as a lawyer, a visiting fellow at Brookings Institution in Washington, and an advisor to Prime Minister Paul Keating. He was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford and graduated from two of the leading Australian universities with dual university medals. Slouch is not a word that comes to mind. He is also a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings and serves on the Council of International Institute for Strategic Studies in London. He writes widely on foreign policy and global issues in leading publications both here and abroad. In 2015, he delivered the prestigious Boyer Lectures and is also the author of several books, including my favourite, Rendezvous with Destiny, How Franklin D. Roosevelt and Five Extraordinary Men Took America and the World into the War and into the World. And that won the 2014 New South Wales Primary Literary Award for Nonfiction. As our executive director, it is usually Michael's role to introduce speakers at the Institute. And so it is a great and somewhat rare pleasure to have Michael himself address the Institute. Over the 6 years he has been executive director, he has introduced, hosted conversations with, and put hard questions to a host of world leaders and leading global figures, including various prime ministers of Australia, and one might say of unfortunately many in that 6 year period. He has brought to Australia and the Institute a diverse range of leaders such as German Chancellor Angela Merkel, former British Foreign Minister Boris Johnson, Papua New Guinea's Treasurer Charles Abel, US General David Petraeus, New York Times commentator Brett Stevens, Commander of the US PACOM Admiral Harry Harris, French Foreign Minister Jean-Marc Ayrault, Pacific leaders such as Samoa's Prime Minister Tuilepa Salele, and dozens more. Michael's last major speech was at the National Press Club in Canberra last year on Australia's place in the world in the Trump era at around the one-year mark of the Trump administration. So it's fitting that just over a year later, Michael is addressing the Institute 2 years into the Trump administration. This address comes on the heels of another bruising year in world politics and a fiercely contested midterm election in the United States. The midterms might seem like, on their face, just another set of American elections, but the United States is Australia's only treaty ally and our primary security partner, and it remains the leading power in the world, both militarily and economically. And this is the era of the great disruptor and great global disruption. So this is an important address at a critical time for Australia and the world. Please welcome Dr. Michael Fullilove.
Thank you very much, Alex. One of the decisions as Executive Director that I'm most pleased with is my decision to appoint Alex as the Research Director earlier this year. And, of course, that was because of her sterling work as Program Director for Polling, but it's reinforced by all the nice things that she just said about me then. So thank you, Alex. As she says, usually at the Lowy Institute, I'm the one asking the questions, so today the tables will be turned. Thank you, everyone, for coming, and in particular, Stephen Lowy from the Institute's board. And I'd also like to mention one of my high school teachers, Judy King, who's come out today, and most important of all, my mum, Pat Fullilove. You know, it's a big occasion when mum's in the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, many of you will know that I've been arguing for some time that Australia needs to step up its foreign policy efforts. In 2015, I was honoured to deliver the Boyer Lectures, which were titled A Larger Australia. And I called the first of those lectures Present at the Destruction, a play on the title of Dean Acheson's memoir about the establishment of the post-war order present at the creation. I argued in 2015 that the country around which the post-war order was constructed, the United States, had stepped back from the world, while powers such as China and Russia were stepping forward into it. The pillars supporting that order were weak, and the principles that defined it were under challenge. The order was not necessarily finished, I said, but it was fraying. Some protested that I was being too gloomy. But since then, we have seen the international system degrade further. Nationalism and protectionism are rising, faith in democracy is falling, strongmen and authoritarians are up on their hind legs, international norms are being flouted, assassinations and extrajudicial executions on foreign soil seem to be multiplying. The United Kingdom is exiting the European Union, which will weaken both Britain and the West. And the leader of the free world is Donald J. Trump. No one is saying now that I was too gloomy. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now halfway through the first term of the Trump administration. And today I'd like to talk about the first 2 years of Mr. Trump's foreign policy, how the midterms will affect US foreign policy, and what this means for Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, President Trump came to office with a more coherent worldview than other recent American presidents. For decades, he has held four core beliefs about the world, and they are not exactly the four freedoms. First, he scoffs at the long-standing American commitment to international leadership and cooperation. During the presidential campaign, he promised to wall off the world and reduce America's international commitments. In his midterm election campaign, he sent troops to the border to stop a caravan of migrants and vowed to end birthright citizenship. Since the 1940s, American presidents have appreciated the advantages of global leadership. Mr. Trump seems oblivious to them. The process of pulling America back from the world did not start in 2016, but it has certainly accelerated since then. Second, Mr. Trump is unimpressed by the alliance network through which Washington has traditionally projected its influence, even though China or Russia would dearly love to have an alliance network as powerful and cost-effective as that of the United States. Third, he is hostile to free trade agreements, or at least those that were negotiated by other leaders. Finally, he has a weird affinity for strongmen, such as Russia's President Vladimir Putin. By contrast, he is lukewarm about most democratic leaders. So those are his instincts. In office, many of these instincts have informed US policy. For example, in relation to American leadership and cooperation, he junked the Iran deal, he pulled out of the Paris Accord, he boosted the Brexiteers and indeed called for other countries to leave the European Union. He signaled that America will withdraw from the INF Treaty with Russia. On alliances, he repeatedly refused to endorse the collective security guarantee of the NATO treaty and threatened that the United States would go its own way if delinquent NATO members didn't increase their defence spending. He's been ambivalent towards bilateral alliances with South Korea and Australia. On trade, President Trump withdrew from the TPP and levied tariffs on $350 billion of Chinese imports. And finally, he has pandered to President Putin. He accepted the Kremlin's denial of election interference over the considered opinion of his own intelligence community. He has emboldened a cohort of strongmen, including the Philippines' Rodrigo Duterte, Hungary's Viktor Orban, Italy's Matteo Salvini, Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman, and North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Now, it's also true that Mr. Trump has had foreign policy successes. He put upward pressure on NATO allies' defence spending, which is a good thing and no small thing. He forced allies such as Canada and Mexico to renegotiate trade agreements. He drew the eyes of the world when he met with Kim Jong-un. But the scale of his successes is mostly modest and certainly less than he claimed. For example, the US-Mexico-Canada agreement is not notably different from NAFTA. It is more of a rebranding than a rewriting. And we have to ask, at what price do these successes come? A stronger party can usually impose its will on a weaker party, but over time, bullying behaviour will undermine the regard in which the stronger party is held. The genius of America's conduct after the Second World War was, as the historian John Lewis Gaddis observed, that Washington established hegemony by consent. But if you push your allies to the brink in every negotiation, that consent will quickly evaporate. At home, President Trump has lowered the bar of acceptable political conduct. His dismissal of all criticism as fake news undercuts the free press and has been adopted by dictators abroad. His violent language helps to normalise political violence on the part of some of his followers. His cynicism undermines liberal values and strengthens the claim of Moscow and Beijing that Western democracy is a sham. As my friend, the New York Times columnist Brett Stevens wrote, the story of the Trump presidency so far isn't catastrophe, it's corrosion of our political institutions, civic morals, global relationships, and democratic values. Think of some of the disturbing international events of the past 2 years. Kim Jong-un assassinated his brother at a major international airport with a chemical weapon. The head of Interpol disappeared in China. A journalist was murdered and dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Turkey, apparently on the orders of the Crown Prince. Once Washington would have cared about these developments and done something about them. Now we hear crickets. The ghastly case of Jamal Khashoggi is instructive. As Susan Glasser, the Washington columnist for The New Yorker, who will soon visit the Institute, wrote recently, this case is the Trump presidency distilled to its morally compromising, press-bashing, truth-denying essence. At a time when many question American leadership in the world, Trump's combination of credulity and cynicism in response to the brutal murder of a dissident who sought refuge in the United States gives the world's bad guys yet another reason to cheer. So, President Trump's worldview has shifted US foreign policy and it has weakened international society. However, the president's writ doesn't run everywhere, and two factors have limited the Trump influence on Trump foreign policy. The first is opposition from within his administration, the so-called deep state. The adults in the room have prevented the president from doing irreparable damage to America's alliances and foreign relationships. They have issued official documents such as the National Security Strategy and the National Defense Strategy, which reflect orthodox rather than Trumpian policies. And for the most part, they have had a positive effect. Thank God for the deep state. However, by now, most of the adults have left the room. There are persistent rumors that Chief of Staff John Kelly and Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis will soon follow the others out the door. Second, the president lacks the patience, discipline, and focus to implement his will. He is not really interested in solving policy problems. He's interested in being seen to win. As Tom Wright of the Brookings Institution and the Lowy Institute argued recently, Mr. Trump's style is to make a bold and unexpected move on an issue, declare victory, and move on to something else. The historian Arthur Schlesinger said of Franklin Roosevelt that details stuck in his mind like sand in honey. No one says this of Donald Trump. He is not a details man. Next steps are not important to him. He prefers cheap cheers. Few observers believe, for example, that scrapping the Iran nuclear deal lessened the chance of Iran obtaining nuclear weapons. Few expect Kim Jong-un to give up his nukes. So goading Tehran and romancing Pyongyang were not real victories. But in the Trumpian era, what happened is a detail. What is seen to happen, what Mr. Trump declared just happened. This is what matters. So these two factors, the deep state's resilience and the president's character have combined to limit the damage Mr. Trump has done to the international system. He has hurt America's interests, he has damaged international agreements, he has diminished America's attractiveness, but he has not yet done irreversible harm. But we should not be too sanguine. President Trump is yet to face an externally generated foreign policy crisis. Most of his problems to date have been internally generated. President Obama, by contrast, came to office in the midst of a major financial crisis. Imagine if another such crisis were to occur and our last line of defence were Donald Trump. As Mr. Trump's confidence increases and the influence of his professional advisers ebbs away, the likelihood of presidential error increases further. This, then, was the foreign policy record submitted to the American people in last week's midterm elections. Of course, the elections were not just about foreign policy. Midterms are traditionally seen as a referendum on the incumbent president. And this time around, President Trump declared them to be so. So, did Mr. Trump win or lose? The answer is, it's complicated. Both sides have something to skite about. The president, of course, described the result as a fantastic success, and he claimed a big victory. And it's true that Republicans increased their majority in the Senate. So Mr. Trump's partisans can say there was no blue wave, only a blue ripple. In his post-election press conference, however, the president didn't exactly carry himself like a winner. Democrats can point to the fact that they won control of the House of Representatives for the first time in 8 years. They also won the House popular vote by 7 or 8 points at a time of record high employment and strong economic growth. Democrats now have the power to check the president's agenda and investigate his affairs. So it's a mixed result. Mr. Trump remains unpopular with the American people, but he has tightened his grip on the GOP. Republicans ran towards Trump, not away from him. Many who had previously criticised or rejected the president, such as Senators Ted Cruz and Lindsey Graham, now embrace him. And several moderate Republicans lost office last week. So Americans delivered a slap, but not a punch, to Mr. Trump. He was not submerged in a blue wave, but the water is now up to his knees. The question is, how will this mixed result affect a person like Mr. Trump? There are two possibilities. On the one hand, he might moderate, as George W. Bush did in the second half of his first term, when he realised that events in Iraq and elsewhere weren't proceeding as expected. President Trump might conclude that in order to maintain his reputation as a change agent, he needs to cooperate with Democrats on areas such as infrastructure. He needs to emphasise the positives of the strong US economy rather than the negatives of immigration. He may invite the adults back into the room, turning over more control of foreign policy to the experts, for example, by empowering Secretary Mattis. But this seems unlikely. It seems more likely that he will double down. Given the likelihood of gridlock in Washington, the president may well get bolder in his foreign policy, Trumpier, if you like, both because he has greater freedom to move abroad and because he thinks foreign winds will help him at home. The president set out these two scenarios the day after the midterms in his press conference. He said that he and Speaker Nancy Pelosi could create a beautiful bipartisan type situation, but if the Democrats came after him, he would adopt a warlike posture. And we should prepare for both possibilities. Certainly, we can now say with some confidence that the United States will not soon snap back to normality. In fact, Mr. Trump is more likely than not to be re-elected in 2 years' time. So America's international posture is unlikely to change anytime soon. So what does all this mean for us, for Australia, a country that relies heavily on its security alliance with the United States, but whose citizens distrust the US president? Recall that Alex's Lowy Institute poll this year found that only 30% of Australians have confidence in Mr. Trump to do the right thing regarding world affairs. Australia believes in a rule-based order. Mr. Trump does not. He doesn't even believe, in fact, in a rules-based order between individuals. He doesn't accept that rules that apply to other adults also apply to him. And he clearly does not believe in a rules-based order between nations. He believes in a power-based order, by which I mean using all of America's power, even against its friends, to squeeze out the maximum short-term advantage for the United States. There are broadly three approaches the Australian government could adopt in response to the Trump effect. The first approach would be to imitate him, to devise an Australia-first foreign policy. Now, no one says explicitly here that we should make Australia great again, but you see hints of such an approach in suggestions that Australia should pull out of various international agreements or curry favour with Mr. Trump by copying his policy positions. Paul Kelly provided a succinct rebuttal of this line recently in The Australian. "The Trump fan club in this country," said Kelly, "doesn't grasp that America is big enough and powerful enough to live with decisions that antagonise much of the world, but that Australia isn't and doesn't escape with such immunity." But even if we could get away with aping his conduct, the truth is that President Trump's instincts are profoundly antithetical to Australia's interests. Mr. Trump is sympathetic to isolationism. Australians are inclined towards internationalism. Mr. Trump is an alliance sceptic. Australians are alliance believers. Mr. Trump is hostile to free trade. Australia is a trading nation. Mr. Trump swoons over autocrats and strongmen. Australia is an old democracy and a free society. Mr. Trump decries globalists, but nearly 4 in 5 Australians agree that globalisation is mostly good for Australia. So an Australia-first foreign policy would make no sense. A second approach would be the opposite of the first. Australia could join the ranks of the never-Trumpers. Our leaders could spend their time refuting President Trump's untruths and fact-checking everything he says. We could edge away from the United States, perhaps even move towards China. This would be an act of self-sabotage. I'm concerned about what President Trump means for the world. Australia should stand up to him when our interests and the international order are threatened, but we should not join the global resistance. For all its frailties, the United States remains the keystone of the international system. And I believe that America is still in play, both its liberalism and its power. There is a good chance that America will be back. I prefer a third approach. I agree with the Australian government's stated commitment to the rules-based order, but I think we should do more to support that order. Now, this would be a hard task for a country our size in the best of circumstances. Australians are often complacent about the world. We are interested in international events, but we see them as things that happen over there rather than things that affect us here. Too often we regard ourselves as onlookers rather than players. And at the moment, of course, our political class is traumatised by a decade of failure and churn. It is hard for governments to be creative when they are beleaguered. The last Prime Minister and Foreign Minister produced a foreign policy white paper that is persuasive on the importance of the rules-based order. But I would ask, what new initiatives is the government undertaking to support that order? What risks will we take? What costs will we bear? Today, I'd like to suggest 8 principles that might inform a larger, more creative Australian policy towards the United States and the international order in the Trump era. First, we need to maintain our alliance with the United States. As my chairman, Sir Frank Lowy, said in this year's Lowy lecture, Australia would be mad to walk away from the alliance. And where exactly would we go? In the long run, it is China, not the United States, that poses the greatest challenge to the existing order. And China's rise makes the alliance more, not less, important. Far from suggesting that Washington retreat from regional leadership, as some suggest, we should urge that Washington reaffirms its presence in Asia. A robust US presence is necessary to maintain a balance of forces in the region. Second, in our dealings with Mr. Trump, we should stand up for ourselves and for our values. We should avoid the example of British Prime Minister Theresa May, who displayed unseemly enthusiasm in her early approaches to the president, culminating in a humiliating joint press conference in the garden at Chequers, in which she looked on as he complimented her rival Boris Johnson and railed against the fake news. Malcolm Turnbull had his famous phone call with President Trump, but the truth is, compared to other allied leaders, such as Germany's Angela Merkel and Canada's Justin Trudeau, he got off lightly. Ladies and gentlemen, Australia's time will probably come with President Trump. And when it does, Scott Morrison or Bill Shorten should stand up for Australian values. They needn't troll the president, but neither should they defer to him. Like everything else in life, the Trump presidency will pass. My advice to leaders is don't do something that you will regret later. Retain your self-respect. Maintain your independent bearing. Third, we should call out challenges to the international order, whether they reside in the White House or Zhongnanhai. In March this year, for example, the then Trade Minister Steve Chobo was asked if Australia would consider supporting WTO action by other countries hit by President Trump's tariffs. He replied that Australia would practice what we preach on free trade. Mr. Chobo was widely criticised in the nation's opinion columns for this statement, but he was exactly right. There is too much at stake for us to keep our heads permanently below the parapet. Standing up to Washington when required will give us credibility when we need to stand up to Beijing. Chobo was correct. We should practice what we preach. Fourth, we should be an exemplar in following international rules and observing international agreements. A country of our size benefits enormously from an international order in which the rules of the road are well established and widely observed. We should, in the words of Ralph Bester, who's the head of policy planning at the German Foreign Office, as he said in a recent appearance here at the Institute, we should ruthlessly play by the rules. One example of this is the Paris Accord. The experts have told us what global warming will mean for Australia. More bushfires, worse heat waves, more droughts and flooding rains, rising sea levels, falling agricultural production. So it is in our interest to play our part in helping the world to avoid the kind of dangerous warming predicted in the latest IPCC report. Accordingly, we should bolster the Paris Accord. The last thing we should do is walk away from it, thereby weakening the case for concerted international action, but also undermining our own reputation as a reliable country that sticks to its word. Fifth, we should thicken our connections to other countries that matter to us, not just the United States. That means doing more with regional powers, including Japan, South Korea, India, Indonesia, and Vietnam, but also doing more with like-minded extra-regional powers such as the UK and France. Now, this is easy to say, of course, and it's hard to do, but Canberra should aim to build these relationships out. For example, it's important that Australia and Japan conclude an agreement to strengthen defence ties as soon as possible. We should also boost our cooperation with Southeast Asian militaries, particularly at sea. Australia is growing its navy because we know the big challenges to our security lie in the maritime domain. We also have an interest in helping Indonesia to increase its maritime capabilities. Stepping up our intelligence cooperation with our neighbours would also be a good thing. I like Defence Minister Christopher Pyne's idea of providing training in reconnaissance and intelligence gathering to ASEAN countries. And I also endorse French President Emmanuel Macron's notion of greater cooperation between Australia, France, and India. We are three democracies with overlapping interests. Working more closely with New Delhi and Paris will open up new avenues of action. The truth is that Asia's diplomatic geometry is changing. The linear application of power will not do the job anymore. Australians will have to bone up on our trigonometry. Sixth, we should work with other capitals to support global deals until the fever in Washington has passed. I commend the Turnbull government for working with Tokyo and Ottawa to keep the TPP afloat. The TPP-11, ratified by Australia a fortnight ago, is a liberal development in a world that is increasingly illiberal, and we should look for more opportunities like that. Seventh, we should help to stand up a new concert of middle powers. Countries that, like us, have an interest in supporting the international order and the capability to help do so. It is past time to institutionalise a group of like-minded middle powers, a coalition of the responsible, if you like. Recently, Ivo Dalda and Jim Lindsay, two American colleagues of mine, suggested that a G9 of middle powers could meet annually at leader or ministerial level, or form an informal caucus within existing institutions such as the UN and WTO. Australia has a distinguished history of institution building from the United Nations and ANZUS to the Cairns Group and APEC, where our interests and values required it and the creativity of our leaders enabled it. We should draw on that history now. I would be delighted to see the first meeting of that group take place in Sydney, and perhaps we could make available the Institute's headquarters at 31 Bligh Street for the leaders to meet if the government wishes. Finally, and perhaps most importantly, we need to bolster our own national capabilities so that we are better positioned to shape our external environment and buttress the international system. If we want the United States to be a responsible stakeholder, then we must be a responsible stakeholder. We should not be one of those countries that opines furiously on international developments but refuses to stump up for a serious defence force. The countries that speak loudly but carry a small stick. We should do what we say. I welcome the progress made by the coalition government in increasing defence expenditure towards 2% of our GDP, and I'm pleased that the opposition has also committed to the 2% target. In the future, a credible ADF may well cost more than that. It certainly won't cost less. For Australia, the era of cheap security is over. Now, in government, if it wins next year, Labor would find this a difficult commitment to meet. Last time it occupied the Treasury benches, it cut defence spending significantly as a proportion of our GDP. I agree with those progressives who say we should lead, not free ride, on climate change. But equally, I would argue that we should lead, not free ride, on the provision of security, especially in our neighbourhood. So I was pleased to hear opposition leader Bill Shorten declare at the Institute last month that the 2% pledge is fundamental. Along with a muscular ADF, we need a better resourced diplomatic corps and a generous aid program. For most of the last three decades, DFAT's budget stagnated and our diplomatic network shrank. This government has arrested that trend. Since 2015, DFAT has opened 10 new posts, and Prime Minister Morrison announced last week another 5 new posts in the Pacific. But Australia's diplomats are still thin on the ground. DFAT fields substantially fewer personnel overseas today than it did in the late 1980s, 30 years ago. Our diplomatic network remains one of the smallest in the G20. This makes no sense. It's also hard to understand the recent cuts to Australia's aid efforts. Since 2014, aid spending has fallen in real terms from roughly $5.5 billion to around $4 billion. As a proportion of gross national income, Australian aid has fallen to its lowest point in half a century. I think we have cut our aid budget too far. We should undo some of those cuts. Foreign aid helps us to do good in the world, but it also helps us to do well. Ladies and gentlemen, I said in my Boyer lectures 3 years ago that Australia's strategic circumstances demanded a larger foreign policy. Those circumstances have deteriorated significantly since 2015, and the results in the midterms have not improved things. The pace of regional diplomacy is picking up. But as we go into summit season, others are making the running. We seem to have lost a step. How could it be otherwise when our new Prime Minister will spend most of the time between now and next year's election introducing himself to his counterparts? Australia needs to rediscover its ambition and revive its history of creative diplomacy. In our dealings with President Trump's Washington, we will need to be a busy ally. But that will not be enough. Australia is a beneficiary of the international order. From time to time, we must serve in its bodyguard. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael, for that magnificent, wide-ranging speech. I'm going to just give you an opportunity to catch a breath briefly before we go to audience questions. Talking about the importance of practising what you preach and not just furiously opining, perhaps you could just opine a little. You ended your talk about with urging allies of the United States to get busy and serve in the bodyguard of the international order. But of course allies have been bruised by their encounters with President Trump, except perhaps
Emmanuel Macron, who had some sort of a bromance going on with President Trump with the kissing and the hugging and the dandruff thing. But that seems to have ended with the recent visit of the last couple of days of President Trump to France. So what do you think that says about President Trump and his allies? Have you got any observations about what happened there in Paris?
Well, Donald Trump is a hard man to be friends with, isn't he? Whether you try to charm him or you try to maintain a distance with him, he will find a way to come at you. It's funny, I've been thinking over the last month or two when I should give this speech and what would be the good timing. I couldn't have scripted it better, in a way, with Mr. Trump's visit to Europe, because his activities in the last couple of years have sort of summed up so many of the themes in my speech. He went to Europe to mark the armistice 100 years ago, which in the Great War, of course, is the evidence of what happens when the international order breaks down. And you think of what he did. He refused to march with the other leaders up the Champs-Élysées. He was very warm with President Putin, much more so than he was with the other democratic leaders. And, of course, he took a rain check on the ceremony for the United States. And then you've also seen, interestingly, a number of the leaders in France pushing back against Mr. Trump. And you referred to President Macron's speech about the difference between patriotism and nationalism. And some of you might have seen a photo I tweeted this morning of Mr. Trump's face when he made that point. And obviously that was directed straight at him. I respect Macron, actually. I think Macron is trying. I mean, he's trying to charm him to the extent that he can, but he's not falling into the May trap of sort of prostrating himself in front of Mr. Trump. And so he will stand up for France's values. And I respect that I respect the job he's doing as a serious leader of a serious country that believes in its values. I don't think that Australian prime ministers and leaders should be going out around, as I mentioned, trolling the president or fact-checking him or, you know, constantly making jokes about him, because that's not really, really advantageous. But I do think that when he makes serious points that really run counter to everything we believe in as a country, I think we should say that. I don't think we should just remain silent and hope it disappears, because you never know in life what's going to become. We don't know what will become of this moment. It does seem to me that this is a dangerous moment in world history, and it is important for democratic countries to publicly state what they believe in.
And just where the Twitter criticism, obviously. Mm. Peter Hartcher made an interesting comment this morning, actually talking about your speech in the Fairfax Press today, picking up on the strands of your speech that President Trump is looking less like an aberration and more like a culmination of the last few decades of global politics. So not just a bad dream, but something that is going to stick. And just drawing on some of the public opinion in the United States, which indicates that he's on balance, he's unpopular, and the midterm results have obviously approved that, played that out. But among Republicans, he's got this massive support base of 90% approval, and the reason his approval actually ends up being negative overall is because he's got absolutely no cross-party appeal. So the polarisation of American society and politics seems to now be entrenched. What does that say about the future of American foreign policy and of Australian foreign policy? How do we deal with it past the next 2 years if Trump actually does get re-elected?
Well, I would say I don't think I quite agree with Peter Hartcher's formulation of this period being the culmination, because I think, as I mentioned, that things have accelerated. This instinct towards stepping back from the world and prosecuting America's interests in a more aggressive way, I think they have really stepped up under President Trump. I think President Obama was just sort of had an intellectual view that America was overextended. But President Trump's quite different. I mean, he thinks that America has been played for suckers. He thinks that all of his predecessors were hopeless. He thinks that America should play its hand completely differently in the world. So The positive out of that, the reason I mention it, is that when Mr. Trump eventually is no longer in the White House, I think there will be a shift back to some extent to normality. But we don't know how much of a shift back it will be. And as you point out, President Trump has changed the Republican Party. I mean, that has gone from the party that was in favour of free trade and expansive military commitments to a much more isolationist GOP, as it was, I might say, between the wars. The Republican Party was much more like that in that period. And the second thing I would say is I think there is every chance that Mr. Trump will be re-elected, in part because that's what normally happens in the United States. Only two presidents since World War II have not been re-elected, and partly because he is a very gifted communicator and politician, and we shouldn't kid ourselves about that. He is amazing. He has a terrific instinct for the jugular, and he's prepared to do anything. He's absolutely shameless. So he's not going anywhere. It's not going to change in the next 2 years. It may not change in the next 6 years. After that, it when he leaves, it will moderate, I think. But we can't say for sure, as I said, that it will snap back to normality. And so the rest of the world has to think, well, what do we do when the oxygen that the United States provided to the international system, when that gets thinner, how do we step in to try to compensate? And that's my eight principles, which are not exhaustive, they're not a complete answer, but it's my attempt from an Australian point of view to craft an answer to that dilemma.
I'm going to open it up now to question and answer, so please identify yourself when the microphone comes to you and try and keep your comment to a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Freddie Sharp. You said a couple of things that seemed rather optimistic, that the Trump may be a fever that dissipates in Washington, or there may be a bounce back when his term or second term finishes. I'd like to just challenge you on that a little bit. How do you see the results of the midterms? Is it driven by the progressive left Democrats like Beto O'Rourke in Texas, which gives us some hope for that pushback? Or is it more the mainstream center-right Republican-light Democrats of Nancy Pelosi? And given the catastrophe of the last election where the Nancy Pelosi Democrats achieved nothing against Trump, why are you so hopeful that there'll be a bounce back to the old normal, given that the new normal seems fairly extreme?
Well, I'm glad that someone found that speech hopeful, because most people I sent it to in advance said that I was pretty dark on the world. I guess I am trying to find, of course, I'm trying to find the light. That's partly my personality, because otherwise it's just too hopeless, isn't it? I think that the Democrats have a very difficult decision ahead of them. How hard are they going to push back against Trump? Do they investigate all his affairs? What does the Mueller report look like when it's issued? If indeed the new acting Attorney General allows it to continue, allows a report to be produced. How hard do they push him on that? How much do they play to where the enthusiasm is, as you say, to those on the left of the Democratic Party? The problem is that enthusiasm makes you feel fantastic. It gets out votes, but typically it doesn't win presidential elections. Usually, not in the case of Mr. Trump, but usually, presidential elections are won by centrists. So the reason I said to you that I think it's more likely that President Trump will be more likely than not that he'll be re-elected is he has the advantages of incumbency, but also because there is this question mark about how the Democrats will go in the next 2 years and whether the Democratic forces will coalesce around a compelling, charismatic figure who can beat Donald Trump. And it's hard to do that, and there's a lot of self-interested candidates. We read in the last day or two a former advisor to Mrs. Clinton, for example, saying that she might run again. So let's see how that settles. Let's see how that settles out. I mean, as a romantic and an idealist, what I like about the American system is that it does allow outsiders like Barack Obama and Beto O'Rourke to come from nowhere to capture the imagination of the American public. That's what happened in relation to Obama in 2008. So I think I think Democrats would be hoping that a new figure emerges like that. I personally think that running somebody like Hillary Clinton or Joseph Biden against Mr. Trump will not produce the result that they want.
Thank you very much for the speech, Michael. Just two questions off the back of your points about aid and then defence. It seems quite recently we've sort of rediscovered aid, the aid budget, particularly as it pertained to the Pacific. And it seemed to me that that was quite soon after talk about China establishing potentially a base in the Pacific region. Just wondered how realistic you think that possibility is and how profoundly that would change the calculus if that was to occur. Firstly, and then on aid, and then on defence, I think when Hugh White did his Australian Foreign Affairs piece a few months ago, he was sort of saying that given the change in power structures, we may need to contemplate the nuclear deterrent at some point in the future. Do you think that's something that is sort of down the road potentially in terms of the calculus as well?
I welcome the fact that in relation to the Pacific and China and so on, I welcome the fact that both sides of politics have rediscovered the Pacific. Both of them have promised to step up, and Mr. Morrison put money behind it last week and posts, and Mr. Shorten, when he was here, Mr. Miles, I should say, when he was speaking at the Institute, also put a big emphasis on the Pacific. I think that's good. And that's the opposite, actually, of Trumpian policies. It's anti-Trumpian policies because Mr. Trump's response would be, you know, to that policy challenge, would be, who cares about these people in the Pacific? What have they ever done for us? Whereas both sides of politics are saying, okay, we've stepped back a bit too much from the Pacific. It's time to reinvest. Is it driven by the spectre of China getting more involved? It is. It is. But I'll take that. If that produces a new focus on a region that matters to us, that's fine. And I think it does have consequences. I think Chinese military bases in the approaches to our landmass do have consequences for us. And China is the big challenge in our foreign policy. I mean, I made this speech about the United States problem, if you like, in Australian foreign policy. Perhaps I'll make another one about the China challenge. I mean, that is a real challenge to our existing order. It's like their country is run according to completely different principles, and we really need to take. I mean, responding to the China challenge is a decades long problem that will involve commitment, money, a willingness to bear costs. And a determination to push back against attempts to coerce us. There are great opportunities in the China relationship, but there are great challenges as well. And one of the things that I regret about the pretty poor state of our political system is that, as I said, it's hard to be creative and ambitious when you're beleaguered. And when governments are surviving from poll to poll and from election to election, it's very hard to face up to a big challenge like the one that China poses. In terms of nuclear weapons, there is a logic to it because nuclear weapons allows a smaller power to deter a much larger power from coercing it. So there is a logic to it, but I don't see any... I find it very hard to foresee circumstances where the political or strategic debate in Australia would allow or drive us towards the development of nuclear weapons. I mean, there's not even an appetite really for nuclear power, peaceful use of nuclear power in Australia. That would be a big step forward. It would involve probably international condemnation. It would only happen, I think, in the most extreme circumstances, and we're not there yet by a long way, I would say.
Hi, I'm Clyde Prestowitz. I'm president of the Economic Strategy Institute in Washington, D.C. I'm here to give you a little hope. I got the impression you don't like Donald Trump. So the initial voting reports showed the Democrats picking up 26 seats in the House and the Republicans picking up 4 seats in the Senate. But my email this morning indicates that recounts have shown the Democrats picking up 40 seats in the House and the Republicans gaining only two votes, only two seats in the Senate. So that's much better. That's a much better showing for the Democrats than was initially announced. Whereas you made the comment, you think chances are better than not that Trump would be reelected. I put it the other way. I think he could be reelected, but I rate the probability on the other side that he won't be. Having said that, however, there's another aspect which I think I want to congratulate you on your comments. Let's suppose Barack Obama came back. One of the things that people don't pay a lot of attention to is that the era of U.S. hegemony coincided with a time when the U.S. economy all by itself accounted for about 30% of global GDP. Well, today it's about 17 or 18%. So the means of maintaining that kind of hegemony just no longer exist. And therefore, very important for the middle powers to play a bigger role. And again, make a comparison. You mentioned Australia getting up to 2% of GDP on defense spending, and I think that's a great target. But the U.S. is spending 4. And given the GDP ratio I just mentioned, the numbers need to more coincide. So anyhow, thank you very much, and I hope I've given you some hope.
Take that as a comment. And I think we had one more question down here before we finish.
Thank you. So Michael Cachell from the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. So firstly, thank you for your comments on resourcing. They're greatly appreciated. But I wanted to ask, you mentioned the need for a bigger Australian foreign policy. So apart from the headline issues you identified, such as climate change and trade, are there any particular niche thematic areas where you believe Australia could exercise more creative diplomacy?
What, apart from the 8 principles I just outlined?
They're greedy here.
Gee, you think all that good work I did for a DFAT would get a friendlier question than that. There are lots of themes that I could mention. I mean, a particular kind of obsession I have is the death penalty. It's a different question. But I've always felt that Australia, I mean, this doesn't really relate to the speech today, but I've always felt that Australia could lead a regional coalition against the death penalty. I know that Maurice Payne has instituted a new strategy for Australia on the death penalty. But given that that's something... given that that Asia is the world's capital for capital punishment, but given that there is also good news from time to time in Asia, like recent developments in Malaysia, I've always thought rather than being out there by ourselves, we should try to work with other abolitionist countries in Asia to push back against capital punishment. So that's one theme that comes to mind. But I think maybe to answer your question a bit more generally, I would just say to finish in the Q&A where I finished in the speech, I do get a sense that we have lost a step as a country. And I know that sometimes people in DFAT find that an unfair criticism. But I was just talking to my colleague Richard McGregor yesterday, and we were observing to each other that I think it was last week that that Prime Minister Abe of Japan was in Beijing seeing President Xi Jinping. And then he ducked back to Japan, where he was visited the next day by Prime Minister Modi of India in his own prefecture. Things are happening in Asia very quickly. And I do feel that we're approaching this with one arm tied behind our back. You think of Mr. Turnbull, he was not a perfect foreign policy prime minister, but he was putting the pieces together on Southeast Asia. He had that big trip scheduled to Jakarta and then to Malaysia and Vietnam. And when Mr. Morrison came in, he continued with the Indonesia trip, which was good, but he wasn't able to get to Malaysia and Vietnam. I think of Mr. Turnbull's Shangri-La dialogue lecture last year that I attended. That was great. It was a very well-crafted speech, but it took him 2 or 3 years in office before he sort of worked up to coming up with that framework for how Australia approaches the regional security order and the China challenge. So what I'm saying is it's very hard for these guys. They're elected and then the next day they're at summit season, they're up to their elbows in alligators. How on earth, when they're dealing with what's happening at home, how are they meant to come up with some strategy for moving the country forward? But that's exactly what we need, because things are accelerating in the region. And it does seem to me that we are a little bit out of the deal flow.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
A masterclass. The Lowy Institute is a place for big ideas. You've given us at least 8 big ideas. In fact, you've been extracted for one more. Thank you very much for putting the time and effort and thought into how Australia should better prosecute a foreign policy in trying times. I'd like to thank you all for coming here today and for your excellent questions. Thank you very much.